Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. And welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Russell Lord, New Orleans Museum of Art Curator of Photographs, and contributor to East of the Mississippi, 19th Century American Landscape Photography. We'll also hear from Baton Rouge novelist Ronlin Domingue about the Plague Diaries, the third in her series, The Chronicles of Secret Riven. Russell Lord came to the New Orleans Museum of Art in 2011 after being a fellow at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Now he's the Freeman Family Curator of Photographs for NOMA. Today we're talking about his contribution to a gorgeous new book, East of the Mississippi, 19th Century American Landscape Photography, and the exhibit that's coming to NOMA October 6th. Russell Lord, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. This is a privilege.
Now, whenever it's a book like this, I always feel like it's the looking life. You know, we have to describe these wonderful photographs for our audience. So talk a little bit about this project.
Well, I have to thank my colleague Diane Wagner at the National Gallery. This was her idea from the very beginning. She realized about 6 years ago that there have been lots of exhibitions about Western American landscape photography, but nobody had really looked at the East, which is interesting because the East, of course, came before the West. So what this project does is it looks at the origins of landscape photography in this country. It was in some ways a more difficult endeavor than looking at the West because the material is earlier, in some ways more primitive, and definitely rarer, and also still very sensitive and fragile. So it took the field until this moment to even get to a point where we could look at this material, where we could handle it responsibly, where we knew where it was.
And it's so interesting how much history this book covers in these photographs. I mean, starting with, and I love that expression, a nation announcing itself, you know, exploring the landscape and the territory, and of course, great landmarks like Niagara Falls. I wonder if you talk about those beautiful end papers, because they're the first thing you see when you open the book.
Exactly. I was particularly excited about those. The end papers come from two daguerreotypes that are in the exhibition, and they are still the oldest known photographs of Canada. They were made from the American side looking towards the Canadian side of Niagara Falls. And we know exactly when they were made because I found the notebook and the diary for the person that made them, and he records all of his attempts to make a daguerreotype at Niagara Falls on April 3rd, 4th, and 5th of 1840, which is very, very early. And the wonderful thing, it's kind of the smoking gun when you find this diary. It tells you how many he made, and then it tells you how long the exposure was for each one. And the shortest exposure was 20 minutes. So it was a laborious process waiting for these plates to expose. And then he also recorded what the weather conditions were like, whether the sun was out the entire time of the exposure or whether it was partly cloudy. It's an incredibly useful tool, and those are incredibly beautiful and early works.
And that dreamy blue, I love that. Absolutely. And this was only a year after photography was introduced into the country, right?
Right. It didn't take long. Photography was officially introduced to the world in Paris in the beginning of 1839. But it didn't really arrive in the United States until the end of 1839. And I'm particularly excited that we actually have a couple of daguerreotypes made in the year 1839 in the United States in this exhibition. And this will be the first time that these things have ever been shown, and likely the only time in our lifetime.
Wow. That's amazing. Now, a lot of this is about technology. The development of photography is about increasing technological developments. And I would say the democratization of photography in a way. So talk a little bit about some of those things that we remember and love so much, like those stereoscopic views.
Sure. I think you're right on. I mean, there are lots of improvements that you can see in the course of this exhibition. It begins with the daguerreotype, which was the first process introduced. And a daguerreotype is a unique image on a metal plate. It's usually copper that's coated with a chemical solution. But each one is unique. It's a one-of-a-kind thing. So the plate that you're going to be seeing in this exhibit and the plate that you see reproduced in the book is the very thing that was in the camera 180 years ago. And then you go from there to the kind of next advance in technology is the negative. And there were paper negatives and there were glass negatives. But what those two things allowed you to do was to make multiple positives. So then photography became a thing that you could distribute. And that's a really important thing because then you can share it. It can become public in a way that it couldn't before. And then the stereoscopic views are wonderful. 3D technology in photography existed since 1847. And photographers used a special camera that had two lenses that took two pictures. They were basically about the same distance apart as the two human eyes. So when you put them together, when you look at them in a special stereoscopic viewer, they superimpose one over the other, and there's a semblance of the third dimension. And so this gave a lot of people, not only in this country but around the world, the opportunity to be kind of armchair travelers, and they could have an experience of the world through these three-dimensional representations of it.
And then they could go out into the world and bring back their own souvenirs when they got their Kodaks.
Exactly. They were
in 1888. Now, your essay in this book has the very provocative title. I love this, The Interested Landscape. And you write about the way photography is used to shape national identity and the American concept of America itself.
Right. I wanted to kind of stress that there really is no such thing as a disinterested landscape. When we look at a landscape picture, we have a tendency to think of that thing as a beautiful image. But they're always much more than that. They're in many ways aspirational. Sometimes they try to highlight the beauty of a country for a reason. Either, you know, this is something that we have that other people don't have. Or in the case of a lot of the Western landscape photographs that were made, they were trying to demonstrate how beautiful and unspoiled the West was in the hopes that people would then go and settle it and move there. So there are reasons that landscape pictures exist. And the idea of having various interests at play, I think, is a very important thing, especially in the eastern part of the country. One of the things that I point out in the essay is that people preceded photography in the American East, but photography, the existence of photography, preceded people in the American West. So by the time photography arrived in the United States, in the American East, people were already here working the land, shaping the land, reshaping it to suit their needs. And so photography became kind of an accomplice in documenting that work. We think about kind of changing coastal wetlands today in New Orleans, or we think about vast construction projects that carve through mountainscapes. And yes, that's still happening, but it's certainly not new. And I think what the pictures in this book demonstrate is that from a very early moment in American history, we were interested in documenting those things and showing what was being achieved. And also sometimes looking at it with a critical eye, thinking about how, for example, there's a set of pictures of St. Louis that document the kind of destruction of a beautiful natural landscape that ultimately became a kind of effluent pond for runoff from a lead factory and very much changed the nature of the St. Louis landscape.
And we should also say for New Orleanians, there are the photographs of J. Dearborn Edwards in this book. So there's a little bit of home, too.
There are some wonderful pictures of New Orleans in the book, and there will be even more in the exhibition. There are some that are not included in the book that will be in the exhibition. J. Dearborn Edwards is a particularly interesting figure. He was born in New Hampshire, but he moved to New Orleans and set up a photographic studio. He actually offered lessons in photography at his studio. But he's unusual in that a lot of photographers in New Orleans were still using the daguerreotype process, that unique image on a metal plate that I mentioned. Edwards was interested in paper photography, so he made glass negatives and then made salt prints, which are prints made with a plain sheet of writing paper that is soaked with a solution of silver and salt. And that is a light-sensitive compound. So they're really wonderful pictures. They certainly show parts of the city that look nothing like the way it does today. But Edwards himself was a very interesting character before he established himself as a photographer here. He was an itinerant phrenologist. So he would go around reading people's scalps and telling them their past and potentially their future. So he strikes me as a very typical figure, even though he's an odd one, in that he came from something that was totally unrelated and decided to try photography as a way of life.
One wonders what he'd think of the selfie, you know? Oh, we've been talking with Russell Lord, who's the NOMA curator of photographs and contributor to East of the Mississippi, 19th Century American Landscape Photography. And this gorgeous book accompanies a fascinating exhibit, which opens October 6th at the New Orleans Museum of Art. Russell, thank you so much.
It's been a privilege. Thank you very much.
Baton Rouge novelist Ronlan Domingue is the author of one of the great ghost stories of New Orleans, The Mercy of Thin Air, published in 2006. In recent years, she's turned her attention to an epic fantasy, the Keeper of Tales trilogy. First was The Mapmaker's War, followed by The Chronicle of Secret Riven, and now the final volume, The Plague Diaries. Ronlan joins us today from the studios of WRKF in Baton Rouge. Ronlan Domingue, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. A pleasure to hear your voice again.
Now, what a journey this has been. Three books in the making. And It all had its origin in a writing assignment in a class at Louisiana State University.
This is correct.
That was a good teacher.
Well, it was a Women in Literature course that I took in spring of 1990, taught by the wonderful Dr. Robin Roberts. And she gave us an opportunity to either do a research paper, you know, as usual, or write our own feminist fairy tale, because we were reading retellings or new versions of fairy tales at the time. And I thought, well, let me try my hand at this. And so I did. So there was this one short little fairy tale about a young girl who lived in a kingdom where women weren't allowed to read.
Ah, you know, that would get me. I mean, that would be my fairy tale.
And
my
you've
nightmare.
Read the trilogy. Yeah, you've read the trilogy, so you know whatever that was became something completely different
it,
in the end.
It did. Now, I love the feeling of these books. They're utterly transporting. I mean, when you read them, you really feel like you're in another world, another time, another life. And you got that from immersing yourself in these old stories of myths and fairy tales.
I wrote that fairy tale, tried to turn it into a novel when I graduated from college, wouldn't take off. I put it in a closet. Fast forward through MFA program, The Mercy of Thin Air, and suddenly here I am with a published book, and what am I going to do next? And I found all of that old material back in a closet. So after I pulled it out, I looked at what I had, and within a matter of a couple of days, whatever the story had been transformed in a way that I can't even describe. This was on a deep knowing intuition level that something was different. What happened was, and this is typical of my process, is I was drawn to read about certain subjects. Even though I didn't intend to perhaps research them, something called to me. And so in the earliest months and throughout the course of the years I was working on the trilogy, I was drawn to fairy tales, folklore, and myths, and read the earliest versions that I could find and translations that I could read, and really just kind of dug deep into that material and then scholarly research about fairy tales, folklore, and myths. And it was just sort of dipping into something we all know on a deep level. It's like a shorthand because it's part of our own histories and our ancestral histories. As I was working on these stories, I was dealing with really deep, profound themes and tropes that extend throughout our human history, as far as I'm concerned.
Now, I have to ask, and this may be a naive question, but did you have the grand scheme of these books mapped out before you began? I mean, how did you allow for the overarching architecture of the series, as well as leaving some room for the surprises that might come along with actual writing?
Well, first of all, I didn't intend to write a trilogy. I actually thought I was just going to write one big, huge epic novel, and that was going to be that. But as I was doing my research, keeping notes on that, and receiving pieces of the story, which are complete fragments, it's images or feelings or pieces of dialogue, or it just really varies. And through the course of, must have been about 2 years before I felt like I had enough pieces to start trying to kind of create the story itself. But I was wrong. Because I started this in October 2006, so toward the end of 2008, I kind of saw the overarching biggest picture you can imagine. So think of the trilogy as just this giant behemoth. And it took a while to sort of start filling in those gaps. And I don't start writing until I have the full arc of a plot, typically. The exception here would be the Mapmaker's War was only supposed to be a very small piece of what I thought was going to be an epic novel. But then Aoife decided, nope, that's not what's going to happen. Aoife is the narrator of that book.
Right.
So I sat down and wrote 26,000 words in 2 weeks, just the spew of her voice, and put it aside, went back to it later, realized there was a lot to work with, and over time started filling in the gaps in her story and realized this wasn't going to be a piece of a book. It was going to be its own book, a prequel, and then what Secret Story was a sequel.
These books deal with such interesting women, Aoife, Secret Riven, as well as many other characters. And so many of these women are concerned with mapping their world, both literally and metaphorically, acquiring knowledge in various ways. And that is one of the richest metaphors for me, as you know.
So
talk a little bit about creating these women.
Well, to say that I created them would actually not be accurate, because I experience them as individuals who show up in my consciousness, fully formed, even though I may not be in on their entire stories and all the idiosyncrasies they may have. But I don't invent anything. And anytime I try to argue with them about, no, you should do this or you should be interested in this, it never worked. Never. Not even with the Mercy of Thin Air. Same thing, but the people of these books were far more adamant and difficult to work with. But Secret, she reveals herself slowly over time. Her relationship with the villain you love to hate and hate to love, Fiumini, whose library she is in charge of archiving, that sort of was one of those surprises that came about. That was not necessarily a plot point that I knew early on. It was something that was revealed in time, much later, probably 5 years into the project.
After you've been reading Beauty and the Beast, no doubt.
Yeah. Yeah, we hit all the biggies. I mean, the Beauty and the Beast, Bluebeard, Little Red Riding Hood, a little bit of Sleeping Beauty when you get toward the end. So those themes and tropes are very heavy, very strong in the story throughout. And then the myth of Persephone and Demeter, which has a bit of a twist. You'll remember that first dinner that Fiumini and Secret have where that's referred to.
Oh, yes. Now, these are all women with great agency and power to move between worlds and make a difference in their world. You give them a lot of gifts.
They are bestowed with a great deal of intelligence and tenacity. Aoife in the Mapmaker's War, and for those who haven't had an opportunity to read the book, and for the record, this trilogy can be read out of order. It doesn't matter which one you start with. You can start anywhere.
Absolutely. But I will second that.
And that was by design, which I realized I had a trilogy. But Aoife, she's extremely intelligent, very driven. Her world is sort of like our Dark Ages. That's the closest thing I could compare it to. She's the daughter of an advisor to the king. She's really supposed to just be a noble woman who's a wife and a mother. But circumstances present themselves so that she has an opportunity to study with a mapmaker. And her father and the king say, okay, fine, you can do that. And she's incredibly gifted at mapmaking and becomes the mapmaker for her kingdom and goes out and maps their lands and has a life completely different from the women that she knows, or most women, period, which makes her incredibly unique and very fascinating. Talk about ahead of her time. That's Aoife. And then Secret, she grows up in a time that mirrors our Victorian era, which is still complicated because, you know, even then, although women were being educated, they didn't have a lot of latitude in terms of what their opportunities were. Secret was very fortunate that her father was very interested in her intellectual development, that she would be educated. And in part, that's because her mother, Zavet, who was a translator, a very complicated character, let's say, She went to a high academy, which is like a university, at a time where most women never did that, and made her way in the world as a translator, forging her own ground. And so that's where Secret's grounding was. But Secret herself, she's very introverted, she's very curious, watchful, observant, but strong in ways that I don't think she even knew she was strong until much later, and that was tested.
What are you most proud of in these books?
That they're a story of transformation.
Yeah.
I knew all along that these books had a purpose. That's what kept me going in the darkest times of working on them, that the trilogy is an allegory for our time right now.
Oh, yes.
The fact that The Plague Diaries took me 2 years longer to write than I thought it was going to makes me wonder if the books understood something that I didn't, that the timing was not going to be right for The Plague Diaries to come out in 2015, that in fact they needed to come out in 2017.
Yes, and it's hard not to give it away, but you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
So, yeah, but every book finds its time, you know?
Yeah, and as frustrating as it was for me to be working on it and digging deeper and deeper and deeper and wondering, why am I having to go so far into basically every aspect of what's in The Plague Diaries?
Mm-hmm.
It was going to have far more of a fairy tale overarching. It was going to be more thematic than detailed. It's the only way I can describe it. Had The Chronicle of Secret Riven just been one big book, which was what was originally supposed to happen. It was my editor who suggested that we split that book into two and turn it into a trilogy, which was probably the right thing to do, but required so much more of me as a human being in so many ways. But that said, these books are what they are, and this is what they needed to be. And I'm remarkably proud of them.
Oh, I don't blame you. I'm proud for you. It is such a journey, and it requires a good bit of the reader. But I think you get to the last page of this book, and you are filled with such joy.
It really means a lot to hear you say that.
I hugged it a little bit after I
did
turned the last page.
All right. I'm going to try not to cry right now because that was what the darkness was supposed to lead to.
Yes. And it does. It does. Mm-hmm. It was so gorgeous. So thank you for that, Ronlin. We've been talking with Ronlin Domingue, whose final book in the Keeper of Tales trilogy is The Plague Diaries. You can meet her Sunday, September 17th at 4 at the Baton Rouge Gallery, and you can see her at the Louisiana Book Festival October 28th. Ronlin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. It's my pleasure.
Every reading generation needs to recast old stories in a new light. One of the most wildly successful of this generation of storytellers is former sixth grade teacher Rick Riordan, creator of Percy Jackson, who's teaching a new generation about Greek mythology, and Magnus Chase, who's finding his way around the nine worlds of Norse mythology. Reading these books is pure pleasure, seeing gods of old intrude into the present day. Magnus, who's a 16-year-old homeless street kid in Boston, is wry and street smart. It's tough not to root for him, especially after you discover he's the son of a Norse god. Rick Riordan's authorial voice is pitch perfect. After writing mystery novels for adults, he began these books when his son, who didn't like to read and had been diagnosed with ADHD and dyslexia, was captivated by mythology. After Riordan ran out of bedtime stories, his son told him, "Make one up." Like a good parent, he did, and he hasn't stopped yet. His greatest test? Running his early works past his students, because, as he said, kids are tough. And kids have embraced this New York Times bestselling author with fervor, as they should. Not only does he provide readers with an exciting look at mythology, he's speaking to the kid in all of us, the kid who feels slightly out of place, who has a sense of possibility and awareness, who wants to prove himself, and most of all, the kid who loves his friends and family and is brave as brave can be. Magnus Chase and the Gods of Asgard, Book 3, The Ship of the Dead, will be published this week. Riordan brings his Norse American tour, get it, to New Orleans, Friday, October 6th at 6 p.m. at the NIMS Fine Arts Center. That's at the Academy of the Sacred Heart, 4901 St. Charles Avenue. Tickets are available at Octavia Books. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Dan Santat signs his hilarious picture book, After the Fall, How Humpty Dumpty Got Back Up Again, Tuesday, October 3rd at 3:45 at Octavia Books. Una Hathaway and Scott Shapiro present The Internationalist, How a Racial Plan to Outlaw War Remade the World, Tuesday, October 3rd from 5 to 7:30 at the U.S. Freedom Pavilion, the Boeing Center, at the National World War II Museum. Free, but RSVP at nationalww2museum.org. Ronnie Virgits signs Saints and Lesser Souls, The New Orleans Views of Ronnie Virgits, Wednesday, October 4th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Bloodjet Poetry Series presents Sarah Scrow, Kim Vodica, and Josh Stevens performing Wednesday, October 4th at 8 at BJ's in the Bywater. New Orleans attorney Russ Herman reads from and signs his first book of poetry, The Topography of Life, Love, and Travel, Thursday, October 5th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Big Class, the writing initiative for New Orleans young writers, celebrates its third annual A Dark and Stormy Night, Thursday, October 5th from 6 to 10 at Felicity Church, 1220 Felicity Street. Ghost stories galore. Tickets are available at 501auctions.com/darkandstormy2017. Noted surrealist scholar and author Mary Ellen Cause discusses the poetry of surrealism, Thursday, October 5th at 7 at Crescent City Books. Military historian Martin K.A. Morgan, author of Down to Earth, the 507th Parachutist Infantry Regiment in Normandy, will discuss rare footage taken with an 8mm movie camera of the attack on Pearl Harbor. That's Thursday, October 5th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie, part of the regularly scheduled meeting of the World War II Discussion Group. History professor Peter Dedek discusses and signs his new book, Saturday, October 7th at 1 at Garden District Bookshop. Octavia Books presents An Evening with Rick Riordan, Friday, October 6th at 6 at Academy of the Sacred Heart. This is a ticketed event. Check out Octavia Books for more information. Today's guest, Russell Lord, NOMA curator of photographs and contributor to East of the Mississippi, 19th century American landscape photography, appears for a gallery talk with Diana Wagner, Friday, October 6th at 6 at the New Orleans Museum of Art. The Women's National Book Association of New Orleans is sponsoring its annual National Reading Group Month event, Saturday, October 7th at the Mid-City Library. The theme is poetry, and speakers include moderator Carolyn Hembry, Stacey Balkin, Gina Ferrara, Julie Kane, Melinda Palacio, and Andrea Panzica. Here's the schedule. 11:30, meet and greet. Noon to 12:30, share your book group experience. And 12:30 to 1:30, panel discussion and readings. Book signing to follow. The Poetry Buffet, hosted by Gina Ferrara, presents Karen Massera, Valentine Pierce, and Trisha Resende, reading their works Saturday, October 7th at 3 at Ladder Library. Illustrator Marita Gentry discusses and signs the children's book, The Cajun Cornbread Boy and the Buttermilk Biscuit Girl, which she illustrated for the late writer Diane de las Casas. James Holland presents his book, The Allies Strike Back, 1941-43, The War in the West, Volume 2, Monday, October 9th from 5 to 7:30 at the U.S. Freedom Pavilion in the Boeing Center at the National World War II Museum. Free, but register at nationalww2museum.org. Jessamyn Ward discusses and signs Sing, Unburied Sing, Tuesday, October 10th at 6 at Octavia Books, and again Thursday, October 12th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. That's in conversation with Nathaniel Rich. Novelist Christopher Swan reads from and signs Shadow of the Lions, Tuesday, October 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Maple and Ladder Book Club discusses Walker Percy's Love in the Ruins, Thursday, October 12th at 6 at Ladder Library. The Friends of the Jefferson Library hold their big book sale October 19th through 22nd. Hours are Thursday through Saturday, October 19th through 21st, from 10 to 8, and Sunday, October 22nd, from noon to 5 at the Pontchartrain Center, 4545 Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.